Hello, and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, the number one comic book podcast on AIPTcomics.com. We've been doing this for over a year, and now we have made it to episode 69.
Nice.
My name is David Brook, and I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth, with two R's in the Forrest, I might add.
Correct. Two L's in the Hollingsworth.
Oh, my God.
And my middle name's Jefferson. Two F's in the Jefferson.
Double the energy, double the fun, double the letters. This is a comics podcast where we talk about the latest news. We have guests on every so often. And we lately have been doing the AIPT Book Club, where we go through classic or iconic comic book story arcs and give you the 411 on what they are and what we like, what we didn't like, so that you can get a little insight before you read it if you haven't yet already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We are what? 4 weeks into no new comics?
Oh man, has it only been that long?
It's about three or four weeks.
It simultaneously feels like a year.
It does. You know, I was thinking this morning, actually, back in like February, people were going, oh my God, it's still 2020.
Yeah.
They had no idea we were going to get to this place. So it's basically that has basically put a wrench in our usual show's agenda, which is pretty structured.
Yep.
It appears, and I'm going to start with the news, if that's cool with you, Forrest.
I'm cool with it.
The top of our news this week, DC Comics killing it on keeping us fed with new content.
Including drama that I can't wait to get to.
There's always drama. So DC last week revealed their DC Digital First lineup, which is essentially new for digital purchase comic books, all a dollar each. And every day is new comic book day, according to DC Comics. And so starting this last Monday, going all the way through Sunday, and then all the way through the next week too, there are these comics you can buy digitally on Comixology and other formats like ReadDC.com, Amazon Kindle, Apple Books, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I'm not 100% certain, but I'm pretty sure most of these came from the DC Giant Walmart books that were print only over the last year.
Yeah, I own a couple of those. I definitely have the Swamp Thing one.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have a couple others as well. They're neat. They're good stories.
Yeah, they're all a bit short. They're all like 14 pages. The Swamp Thing story actually comes out today, Sunday. Swamp Thing New Roots number one, it's called. And if you go to aptcomics.com, we have a little bit of a preview for each one of those.
Oh, so there's multiple then. Because I think that was a later Giants issue.
Yeah.
Because they originally led with Tom King written one, which was like a winter special Swamp Thing.
Oh, yeah. Huh. I remember that. Yeah.
Who expected Swamp Thing to be the hero of the Walmart comic?
They had that excellent horror one. I think it was the first horror one they did.
Yeah.
Capullo drew it. That was so good. So next week, basically all of these stories are continuing every day of the same day of the next week. So next Sunday is Swamp Thing New Roots number two.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it's coming out. So it's a cool way to give us new content, even though it's not brand new. It's still new.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate that they're experimenting. It sounds fun. It gives you, a comic fan, something small to look forward to every day. But my brain is too full of holes to keep track of that. And I do hope that they release them as packs or something on Comixology at the end.
Oh, that would make sense, yeah. Because they're 99 cents now, and I'm not sure how many issues are in each
story. Oh, I like that they're that affordable, too. That's cool.
There could be only three. I'm not sure. They haven't said how many stories
I really commend them for experimenting and trying and getting out in front of this and speaking directly to customers.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. Rather than Marvel's attempt at whatever they're attempting, I guess, but which has been primarily limited to media and retailers.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because Marvel said they were willing to go to sell digitally, I think, at one point, but. Or did they not say that? No, actually,
I don't think
that
was
DC.
Yeah,
that
was DC. Did.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then Marvel's just kind of doing weekly updates.
Right. You know, and it's interesting, too, because DC is actually printing comics and sending them out.
And shipping, yeah.
Yeah, next week, they have three brand new titles. Daphne Byrne number 4, which is part of the Hell House Comics line. Batman Giant number 4, which is, of course, yet another one of those Walmart giant-sized books. And then The Dreaming number 20, which is the finish to Cy Spurrier and Bilquis Elvely's the Dreaming series.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It is awesome. It is.
Who's picking that up? G. Willow Wilson.
Yes.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, it's unclear when that's coming out. I think they've actually released their schedule for the next 2 or 3 weeks. Again, though, it's only a couple books. They're not putting out their full force of the usual 15 to 20 books. They've already made it clear that Death Metal isn't coming out till June. Batman's not coming out till June. They're holding those big titles for when comic shops are back in business.
And one thing that I loved about that, you said Death Metal. Snyder on Twitter alluded to that it has gotten bigger and more important than ever.
Yes.
During the quarantine, which means I guess him and Capullo have probably still had time or more time to work on it now.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And DC has pivoted away from 5G to make this an integral story.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned it because he's been doing interviews with Newsarama here and there the last couple of weeks. And one of the interviews he mentioned, he's setting out to fix the DC universe and the line. So this might be the crux of it. When he said
every
that it's
every time, yeah. Every time,
what
they do this every 2 years at this point. It used to be like every fix 10 it? Years,
yeah,
and now it's like every 2 years they do this soft reboot or super hard, super rigid reboot. Mm-hmm. They always overcorrect one way or the other. They always say they're gonna fix it. They always say that they're gonna give fans new things but also old things. It's exhausting. Yeah.
It's hard to keep track of.
Yeah.
I get it from like a selling point in that you're probably trying to capture the interest of a 15-year-old kid who may not know the backstory, right? And now they can jump right in. And then you've hooked that kid for the next 10, 15 years. And then when the reboots, you will just stay on because you love the series and all these books. Maybe that's the idea? I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. I personally don't find like the idea of canon that important. So I'm willing to ride with it and see what they're willing to do and experiment with and new stories and stuff. I am a little obviously tired of Snyder and Capullo getting their take on the DC universe. But whatever. Sure.
I mean, they're the biggest sellers, right? For the last 10 years straight.
Yeah.
Years?
And I think DC's feeling a little creatively actually, they have their management and marketing and shipping on lock for now. Creatively rudderless without Didio, and they're looking to fill a void. And of course, you would pick your two highest performers to do that.
And you already had Death Metal set for the summer anyway,
right?
When they say it got bigger, I have a feeling what that probably means is it got another issue, maybe.
Yeah.
And probably there's some like one of those one shot primers they did for like the first Metal series.
Alpha and Omega type things. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's great too, because what it probably means is there are creators out there getting work that they wouldn't have.
Yeah. I mean, even if there's more tie-ins, that's cool too.
Right.
More work for people.
As long as people are continuing to get paid during this hard time, I'm happy.
Yeah. I applaud DC for getting books out.
You know who's not happy? Diamond. So in the news over at Newsarama, Chris Arendt reported that Diamond refutes DC's notice to retailers about canceled orders. So DC, when they came out and said, okay, we're going to be shipping books through another means by at the end of the month, which is next week. We are canceling all the orders to the direct market between April 1 and April 15th.
Yes. Yeah.
Through Diamond.
Yep.
And what did Diamond say?
That following Monday, Diamond's parent company, Gepi Family Enterprise, sent its retail partners an email entitled, in caps, breaking news, DC Comics ordering update, which contradicted what DC had told retailers that previous Friday. So they contradicted the message over the weekend. We appreciate your patience as we work with our longtime partner, DC Comics, on details following their recent announcements regarding their upcoming slate of weekly periodicals. And then it continues for a bit. It says that they have not canceled those orders, that they're in the warehouse, and that Diamond's going to deliver them.
Nice.
And that DC is still a premier Diamond publisher, but they will not comment on the specific language within those contracts.
Premier. I like it.
Yeah. It's like the silver tier at a convention.
So they're not happy with DC, clearly, right?
I don't think either party's happy with each other, and they're obviously not mediating.
No.
They're, like, firing these little pot shots at each other.
I don't know what Diamond is expecting when they're like, no comics, and I mean, everyone's yeah,
Diamond
like, what?
Diamond has totally shit the bed.
Yeah.
It's
really unfair.
DC's got other partners they're picking up the slack with. I'm really impressed by how quickly they put that together.
Yeah.
And actually, I think I said last week that I was hesitant about it seeming very tangible because of how quickly the Comics Hub thing fizzled out.
Yeah.
But this does seem very tangible, and they've picked good partners that I'm sure they've vetted. And industry-wide, known as good partners like Midtown Comics and stuff like that. Though I right. do see the fear for some local comic shop owners, and I saw people talking about this, where they're like, well, I have to buy... A store owner might feel like they have to buy books from a competitor.
Right, yeah.
Because Midtown is a direct competitor.
Yeah, that is a bit weird.
And it's weird, but you're doing it through DC.
Right.
It's not like you're calling up Midtown and being like, hey, I don't have issue 6 of Silver Surfer or whatever.
That'd be like if DC was like, hey, we can no longer give you advance review copies, but if you go to Newsarama...
Right, right.
They'll hook you up, don't worry. And I'd feel a bit weird about it, but I'd be like, fine.
Right, and it's strange, but it's strange times.
Yeah,
of course. I think that whiplash, that hesitancy, shows that people have been relying on this one distributor, Diamond, for way too long. And that the directs market is archaic and old and clandestine in some ways.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand the over-reliance on it. And I think that having stock is better than not having stock, whether people think that they're going to get it from Diamond or whether they're going to get it through DC's new channels.
Right.
Can't sell comics if you don't have comics.
Nope. You know, and just to touch back on the titles coming out next week... I think one of the reasons why DC's kind of pivoted and done this and started shipping single issues again, mm-hmm. a couple single issues again, Daphne Byrne, The Dreaming, those are two books that'll sell like hotcakes when collected in the fall.
Right.
They need to get these single issues out now so that they can start printing the books that'll go to bookstores and stuff next fall.
Right.
This is a logical move because, I mean, I guess the other option would be to just not print the rest of the issues and just print it in a trade paperback, but then you're kind of losing some money right there.
Totally, absolutely.
So
yeah, that, so I think sense. I think Diamond's having a meltdown about that.
Yeah,
because like you just eloquently pointed out, I'm a little slow this morning, I guess. They're also thinking about what they're going to be able to ship in like September.
Yeah,
and DC's beating them to the punch.
Yep.
And that's not well, it, to be frank, it's not very partnerly from DC,
I guess.
Also, it's born out of Diamond's mistake.
Right. They've, so, DC, what can DC do besides
right,
pivot?
Right.
I mean,
well, they could tell us every Monday that their comics weren't coming out.
Let's jump to that news. On Friday, Marvel revealed they will not be releasing any comic books digitally or physically, single issues, that is. Next week, which is a little earlier than usual. Usually they would tell press on Mondays.
Mondays, yeah. And again, like, I think I said this before, but to reiterate, they're not telling that directly to customers.
Right.
I think, I don't know if they're telling it directly to LCSs, but they are to media, and I guess it was posted on their website in this case, although I don't think previous ones have been.
Yeah, it's unclear. It's hard to follow.
It's weird. I don't get it. It's so weird to see DC and Marvel this like diametrically opposed.
Yeah, I was thinking that Marvel would start to pivot too now that DC's revealed what their plan is for the next few weeks.
They have to.
I think at this point
they don't see that they need to.
Like we talked about last week on the news, Diamond's planning on coming back mid to late May. I'm thinking Marvel's just going to wait till then.
I guess. That's crazy.
It's particularly interesting with Marvel because the breaks came just as their huge event was about to drop. Like, crazy timing right there. Whereas Death Metal wasn't necessarily ready to go, so they could sort of plan for the next month or two and just delay a month. I could see how Marvel's like, shoot, we have all these books in the canon, all these tie-ins in the canon ready to shoot off. what do we do? Let's just hold and take a complete loss for April.
Yeah, for
But you're right. Like I've been saying on the show for weeks, I can't believe they haven't released something digitally. Like anything. Just one or two titles.
Anything.
Yeah. Todd McFarlane was right. If they released Empire Number One, yeah, they would lose a lot of money, probably.
Yeah,
like
totally.
$200,000. But guess what? You would now have every comic book fan who expects new comics every week reading that book, even if they never read Marvel. You could potentially have just hooked hundreds of thousands of new people into the Empire event for free.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get it. Give away free Marvel Unlimited trials, or give away Comixology books for 99 cents or something. Anything.
I think Comixology Unlimited did give away 60 days.
Oh, that's cool.
Free trials starting like 2 weeks ago. Cool. But yeah, I mean,
but I, new I books, just though, like, DC's a great way to them hook. Dead in the water.
Yeah. Jim Lee's not leaving anyone dead in the water, though, as he continues his 60 days of 60 sketches to benefit comic book shops. Last week, I informed everyone on this show that we would be getting the exclusive sketch for Sunday, and it got bungled a bit, the timing of it, and that actually went to Multiversity Comics, but we got ours Wednesday, and it was Batman Gotham by Gaslight, which was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
That is awesome. This whole thing has now earned, wait, let me double check the number. It has now pulled in $160,000 for the Comic Book United Fund.
That's crazy. That's awesome. I did see crazy, a lot of those creators for comics auctions ended late last mm-hmm. week. Mm-hmm. And I saw like Donnie Cates posted the very first sketch that Ryan Stegman gave him of Absolute Carnage.
Oh, wow.
It was the very, Ryan had drawn it and given it to him at a, what do you call this? A summit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the very first one. And Donnie also said, this is also the only art I own from our run.
Wow.
And I'm putting it up for auction. And someone led with $1,500. So, nice. And all of that money is going to charity. So that's awesome.
Yeah, there's been a lot of good work done by creators to help the comic book shops out there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So yeah, Jim Lee's continuing on. I think, what is he at now? He's probably at 25 now. So he's got a couple more.
If he started at the top of the month, he would be, as of our recording, yeah.
The sketch that we got was a little late, in part because the person who bid and won the previous sketch flaked. And so Jim Lee...
Oh, that's...
And that person was supposed to pay, obviously, but then also give him the next character he would draw, and he didn't get it. So then he went to the internet or social media and asked fans what he should draw. So it ended up derailing everything in almost 24 hours.
Times are strange, man. Nothing's predictable. Everything's fake. Diamond's fake.
Fake news.
Friendship with Diamond ended. Now DC is my best friend.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Give him a big hug.
I did see this last week, too. We didn't put this in the news, but TKO had launched very early on, I think like the second day of most statewide quarantine, that they were going to, if you bought their books, physical delivery, they would donate some of those funds, the same funds that a comic store would normally get, to your comic store of choice. And I saw people starting to get those checks and issues last week.
Did you see the store that tweeted out the picture of the check, and it was $69?
Nice.
And TKO was like, nice.
Nice.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's really... You know what's funny is I've been checking back on TKO's website every few days because I want to get their newest books. There's no information on their site, though, like when the new books are coming necessarily.
I felt that way about season two.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do think it's very cool. Them. They come with letters that say, like, you supported your local comic store.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff. So that's awesome.
That's huge.
I keep ending all these nice news bits with, that's awesome.
You know,
but I think it is. I think it's awesome to see the community come together like this.
I have a fun fact about TKO that I learned via the TKO CEO last week. His wife designed the Mad Men opening credits.
Huh, neat.
Or she was part of it. It was a team, of course.
Cool.
It is neat. Yeah, there's a really cool, not comics related, but there's a really cool article with an interview with her and her team about how that animation came together. They won an Emmy for it. So TKO is one step to a Emmy if you do the Kevin Bacon game.
One what degree of separation.
Yes, there you go. Yeah. I couldn't remember it. In our next bit of news, Kodansha Comics has signed with Inky Pen app, adding Attack on Titan, Parasite, and others to the Nintendo Switch reading app. Whoa.
Yeah. So you can now read many of the world's top manga on your Nintendo Switch using Inky Pen, the all-you-can-read manga subscription service. Inky Pen has joined forces with Kodansha, $7.99 a month.
Not too bad.
And I think that's $7.99 a month for all of Inky Pen, not just Kodansha. But Kodansha is adding Attack on Titan, Parasite, Battle Angel Alita, Fairy Tail are the big titles. And then they said, and much, much more.
Yeah, and those, I'm not 100%. I think Attack on Titan is a bit scary, but most of those are
Parasite is also a horror comic.
Okay, so Fairy Tail is definitely for all ages.
Yeah.
The others, not so much.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. But then, yeah,
the Switch Alita's audience isn't just kids.
And violent. And,
yeah. And kind of bizarre.
Yeah. So, I think this is pretty neat. It's a cool way to get comics to people. Also, Nintendo Switches are sold out. But I don't think anyone's buying a Nintendo Switch first as a manga reading tool.
No, probably not.
I don't know that I would think it would feel very natural to read on my Switch.
Yeah.
As much as I like my Switch and as much as I do play like on the couch and in bed and stuff with it. Nice. I think I would rather read manga on my Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's kind of a book format.
Yeah, the size of it.
Yeah. The Switch, of course, has a nicer screen and is backlit and stuff like that. But,
They need to add, like, interactive elements where you have to press A really fast or the page won't turn.
That would be pretty cool, actually. So I would love to see how many subscribers that they have.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, like, at $7.99 a month, which is not insignificant, I guess, as in terms of monthly charges.
I mean, that's pretty much the cost of one manga.
That's true. Yeah. So, if they have a trial, maybe I'll check it out. I did think it was an interesting way to get stuff to people.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the manga out there you can get on Comixology. Especially, mm-hmm. you can get the chapters on Comixology too. So not just the volumes.
And cool. Comixology has a ton of manga in their unlimited section as well.
Right. That's true. Something that was in the news on Saturday on amptcomics.com, which I thought was kind of interesting. Yen Press is releasing a series called Fruits Basket.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Every time I say it, I'm like, is it Fruit Basket or Fruits Basket?
Manga and anime.
The press release that they sent us, it talks about how it's being released simultaneously in English and Japanese, which I thought was kind of neat.
Wow. I don't know that I've ever seen one sync up like that before.
That's pretty rare. There's usually at least a month or two between for the translators to get to work.
That's cool.
I would love to see that more of that, just because, you know, I've reviewed a bunch of Kodansha and other like Viz and stuff over the years here, and it's always kind of like when I go to find images, I find out there's like seven chapters still are already out. They're like, you can see people are, there's all these websites, I shouldn't be talking about this because I don't want to support them, but there's all these websites where people translate the manga that's already out in Japan. When I'm looking for images, sometimes I'll find a page, I go, oh, this is one of the best pages, I want to use this in my review, and then I go, wait a minute, that translation is not the same, and then I realize it was because someone, like, you know, so the non-official version, someone translated, which is kind of sketch. But
that's an interesting conversation. It's also a conversation around like subs and dubs, mm-hmm. because dubs are almost never in sync with subs. And there's kind of a westernization. I would be curious to do a study and see whether fan translations or official translations were more westernized.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like in terms of both visible content art and writing.
I wouldn't want to support those though, because those are obviously just ripping off.
No, sure. I get that. But I think so much of it already exists that you could launch a study regardless.
Oh, sure.
I do think it's hella weird when I'm like catching up on Dragon Ball Super, the anime,
mm-hmm.
and people on Twitter have read way ahead.
Yeah,
like,
right?
Years ahead. And they're like, well, I can't wait for blah, blah, blah.
Right. It's hard to get into the discourse if you're not all the way to the latest.
It does require more catch up than not.
Right.
And I'm curious, I don't know how far ahead or how in sync this Inky Pen app is either.
True. It's probably
new things. I think it's probably more like Comixology Unlimited, where it's slightly right. older things.
Right. It's a starter for you to get into the series. Yeah. Okay. In our last bit of news, Bill Sienkiewicz made a splash with his buttocks.
Yeah.
Over on Twitter, he tweeted about how I'll just read it. With absolutely no apologies, nor shame, apparently, I'm presenting a reference photo I took of myself on FB's Throwback Thursday photo thread. Little did I suspect that people would be so willing to run gloriously riot with my ass. It's a picture of him holding a gun, and he's twisting, and he's got a box over his bum. But I assume this is the only version that exists on the interwebs. And people were losing it over, yeah, I guess, how fit he was.
So tons of people took the photo and made their own reference art and put it into different yes. situations, stuff like that. Some people did amazing stuff. There's like a gauche painting mm-hmm. With cherubs covering his butt and stuff. And then also someone almost immediately was like, I know exactly what cover this was for, and posted a picture of Black Widow on the cover. Yeah. It looks like Jessica Drew is in the foreground.
I think it's Daredevil.
Oh, probably. You're right. Yeah.
I actually reviewed this series a couple weeks ago.
And
that cover is a bit much.
it is that exact pose, though.
She's like presenting herself. It's very risque.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty funny.
But you're right. It is funny. It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Kind of cool to see. I mean, you're kind of getting to see the process Bill Sienkiewicz goes through, right?
Yeah.
Taking photos of himself and drawing.
I love when artists post reference photos like this. Like David Aja posted a picture of himself getting pantsed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's I think was probably for Hawkeye.
Doesn't he look a lot like Bruce Willis in Die Hard here? I feel like that's like a Die Hard moment where he's got the gun and everything.
I guess. Yeah.
In another universe, Bill Sienkiewicz got the role in Die Hard, and Bruce Willis became an artist that no one liked. Just like his jazz.
Some people in these replies are posting the Chip Zdarsky was banned from Twitter for a day because his header photo was a picture of his bare butt in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
People are posting that in the replies. That's pretty funny.
A little positivity.
Yeah, just a little, you know, 69 news for you. I think he looks more like Edward Norton in Fight Club.
I don't think he was that muscular.
Folks, take it to the Twitter.
Just really quick, can we run down some key facts about comics in 1969?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you go to Wikipedia, there's a whole listing, but I wanted to pull out some of the cool facts. Comic history of 1969 on the 69th episode of the AIPT Comics podcast.
Nice.
At the top of my list of things that happened in 1969, Vampirella was, her first issue came out.
Perfect.
Isn't that perfect? I don't know. The one of the most sexualized comic book characters in history.
Do you think at the time he actually had it, the artist actually had it done in like late 68 and they were like,
That's funny.
Let's hold on to this one.
I don't know. In 1969, were people as present with 69?
Yes, come on.
What is 69, by the way? Is it like, is it because the numbers look cool?
I think it's a more like a yin and yang thing.
Oh, okay. That's why it's funny.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes sense. So it's like a Western medicine thing.
It's like, haha, look at these silly numbers. They're actually the same.
That is hilarious.
Nobody ever noticed that they're the same number. You know, that kind of thing.
That makes sense. Yep. Was there anything else, anything you wanted to pull out? I have some other things to talk about.
There was a bunch of really depressing things that I saw in that list. I didn't grab anything as good as Vampirella.
Yeah, there's some deaths, of course, as there is every year.
Have you seen I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson?
Oh, no. What's that?
It's a sketch comedy show on Netflix.
Oh, okay.
And there's a bit where they do like a Baby of the Year awards. Mm-hmm. And they include like an what do you call that?
Oh, I saw that.
In memoriam segment.
Yeah. Yep.
And they include like Little Dinky Doo run over by a truck. And one of the panelists is like, they don't usually include how the person died.
No, that's true.
This Wikipedia list includes all the details.
Yes.
On all the comics deaths in 1969. Someone did their research.
Wikipedia, man, that's a whole other world.
Yeah.
I can't imagine caring so much to get the details right like this.
Yeah.
Another big moment in 1969 was the Serpent Crown was created in Submariner number 9, which is a big story element right now in Marvel Comics, in the Conan series there, where he's in Las Vegas. This latest issue is due to come out next time Marvel releases comics.
I think a lot of things are, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. The founder of Mile High Comics started selling comics at age 13 in 1969.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
In Boulder, Colorado. And now he's selling comics for DC Comics exclusively.
That's pretty cool.
his company is, anyway. A lot of interesting little bits, but nothing too groundbreaking in 1969, aside from it being such a silly number.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to our AIPT book club. As you might already know, if you listened to our show last week, Swamp Thing is our book club story arc of the week. It's going to be, we're going to be looking at the Saga of the Swamp Thing book one, which collects issues number 20 to 27, which of course is Alan Moore's first stab at the character with artist John Toltleben in 1982 it came out. So this is my chance to talk about the series.
Go for it.
So yeah, so in this segment, we're going to be talking about the story so far, what works, what doesn't, favorite artistic moment, favorite narrative moment, and where we think this is going, which is kind of hilarious considering how this is a book that is what? Can't do math. 1, 2, 30, almost 30 years old.
Yeah.
Dang. So yeah, Alan Moore takes over the series from Len Wein, and in a kind of fascinating twist when I started reading this series, because I don't remember ever reading it, but I might have. Alan Moore is finishing off Len Wein's story arc with the first issue, which I don't think normally happens unless someone was fired from a book. And of course, Len Wein is the co-creator of Swamp Thing, so that's another reason why it was a bit of a shock. Anyway, this story, not to spoil, we're not going to spoil too much, don't worry. And this is pretty much a story element that
isn't
a spoiler.
But it is a 30-year-old comic.
It is a 30-year-old comic, too. So that's true. How dare you spoil Star Wars? So basically, Alan Moore takes the character who originally was Alec. What's his last name? Alec Holland. And Alec Holland was turned into Swamp Thing, right? He was blasted in this research facility and combines himself with the Earth, basically, and the swamp. Mm-hmm. Well, Alan Moore flips that on its head. In the first two issues of this seven-issue arc, Alan Moore proposes and reveals that Alec died in that explosion. And in fact, his consciousness was blasted into the green, into this power of the swamp. And for the longest time, he thought he was Alec. But in this arc, he discovers, no, he in fact is a monster of the swamp.
It's basically like an amalgamation of plants and the green that has the memory of being Alec Holland.
Right.
Is in no physical or psychological way actually Alec Holland.
So there's like an identity thing going on in this arc where Swamp Thing is realizing who he really is, and he doesn't really know who he is yet. So there's a lot of development you could do going forward, hence why the series continues on with Alan Moore covering it. So in this series, not only is there an identity thing going on, not only is it wrapping up Len Wein's story, but also there is a scary yellow dude. What's his name?
The Floronic Man, Jason Woodrue.
I don't know. I feel like he should have workshopped that name a little more.
What's that?
Floronic Man.
That works. It's apt.
He's a creepy dude, man. I love
that also his last name is Woodrue.
Of course. There is this, the potential for puns when you read this book is
it's massive. Yeah.
This character is basically tasked. He's pulled out of jail and tasked with trying to understand Swamp Thing now that he's dead. Because in the first issue of this arc, he is shot up and seemingly killed.
And then frozen. Yep.
And the Floronic Man discovers some truths about Swamp Thing, not least of which is his identity. And in his discovery, he himself gets connected to the green. And gets supercharged.
By cannibalizing Swamp Thing, basically.
Right. And he starts eating the yams that are coming out of his body.
Yeah.
I hate when that happens. So anyway, as the story goes forward, the Floronic Man basically is going to kill all of humanity. The Justice League is integrated into the story arc, which is kind of cool for a first arc. That's a bold move, Cotton. And I think I can leave it there as far as the story so far. What do you think?
I think the only thing that you might want to include is that this, it heavily features Abigail.
Yeah.
And her husband, Matt Cable.
Poor husband.
Hmm?
He's this poor guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. And it also, it kind of in the periphery, at least for now, for this first arc, it features Matt Cable's dealings with hell. And with altering reality and stuff, but it's very much in the background. right. setting up things that happen much later in the Swamp Thing run, which I've read the entirety of a long time ago. But I did remember quite a bit of this, and I remembered where some of these little story angles and stuff like the Monkey King end up going into silly and also very awesome philosophical, awe-inspiring moments, kind of in equal measure, which I would say the whole volume does.
I think at its core, Alan Moore, at the root of this, Alan Moore was going for, wait, let's just go all in on the monster. He's a monster.
Yeah. I think we can get to this later too, but it felt so much to me like reading Immortal Hulk.
Oh yeah, okay.
In like an exploration of the duality of this creature and relying more heavily on the creature side.
There's like a philosophical and psychological thing going on that's quite deep.
Right.
That you have to sort of navigate amongst the horror imagery and, you know, the Floronic Man's madness.
Right.
I love this. There's a scene where Superman's like, his posture changed like 17 times in that 5 minutes. And it's like, he's clearly not right in the head. And that kind of thing you don't normally see in like a comic story. It's kind of an interesting little moment where someone's like, oh, wait, I am seeing the trouble with this person. Mm-hmm. Whereas usually it's like, you know, Lex Luthor's like, I'm going to take over the world. Everyone's like, no, don't do it. No one's like, hey, he blinked 45 times. That means.
Right, right.
I mean, Alan Moore obviously is a genius, especially when he was writing this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is some of the best written comics, internal narration, in particular, that you will ever find.
And if you've read Scott Snyder's run on this, as well as Jeff Lemire's run on Animal Man, when they took on that amazing arc.
The Red,
God, when was that? Like, early 2000s?
That was right at the beginning of New 52. And then Charles Soule ended up finishing Snyder's run.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
This so much inspired that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I would say that is basically just a mix of this and Grant Morrison's run on Animal Man.
Right.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was the pitch in the room.
Probably. It would have sold.
The idea of the green is quite fascinating, too. I believe Alan Moore is introducing it in a new way here.
Yeah, in that it is sentient and omnipresent, but also obtuse, I guess.
Right.
Because Swamp Thing is the, what do they call him? The patron of the green?
I think that's right.
He's basically the hero of the green. And so he's communing with the green, and his interpretation of what the green wants and what the green's goals are or what it needs to exist is entirely different than Jason Woodrue's when Woodrue gets plugged into it. And so it's much more abstract than previous interpretations have been, I guess. Mm-hmm. Previous interpretations of Swamp Thing had been a kind of horror Captain Planet.
Right.
And this abstracts that a bit more in a way that I really appreciated.
Captain Planet. I'd read that book.
Yeah.
So what works for you in this?
So there's a lot of things that work for me. I think the art is amazing. I think that there's a lot of really, really awesome, obviously carefully thought out page turns and stuff like that.
Framing layouts, yeah,
absolutely. And in a kind of like it's very 80s. You know, it evokes the art of all the posters of, like, I can't think of the name of the guy.
Cronenberg?
No, not Cronenberg. Well, it's very Cronenberg-esque, totally. And then also, why can't I think of the guy that directed The Thing? John Carpenter.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very evocative of all of like the Cronenberg and John Carpenter-esque posters and stuff like that. I appreciate that very much. I really, really appreciate what Alan Moore is doing here, though, narratively, more so than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's very psychological. It's very dense. It's very poignant. There's points made about humans' relationship with the Earth and stuff that I don't think was in a lot of other comics at this time. This was kind of the height of like silly comics, or like really over the top, crazy clown house comics. And Alan Moore was like, no, I'm going to write like an eco-conscious biopic nightmare. I appreciate that a lot. I also appreciate like there's a lot of like diametric opposition and parallelism in it. There's one issue in particular called Swamped, which is very literal, right? Like, he's literally a swamp thing, but then also they explore how Jason Woodrue is feeling swamped, how Swamp Thing is feeling swamped, and how Abigail is feeling swamped, and that issue is heavily reliant on, like, you'll turn the page, or, like, a page will end with the word swamped for Swamp Thing's bit. It's kind of a book, an issue split into thirds, and it will mm-hmm. end with Swamp Thing feeling swamped about, you know, the identity of Alec Holland and reconciling that, and then it'll say swamped on the end of that page, and then you turn the next page, and it leads with swamped, and it's about Abigail trying to get away from her husband, or something like that. And the way that he's kind of seamlessly built all of these narratives, almost kaleidoscopic, they're through different lenses, but the same world and the same issues. You don't see comics writing like that very often. You don't see stories delivered in equal measure like that very often. It spends as much time with all of its characters as it does with the titular character.
Right.
And it gives them all their due. And I just really, really appreciate that.
Right. There often Swamp Thing isn't even in the book for a couple pages.
Right. Yeah. And it's especially and it's, when it's rooted. Absolutely nothing like Swamp Thing had been before this.
Right. Right. This book was so ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very.
At the same time, though, it's very pulpy, right? It's like those pulp novels.
It is. I mean, I think he's having fun with it, right? Like, he's definitely chuckling to himself as he writes, like, the puns and stuff in.
Right. Or, like, when they reference Creature of the Black Lagoon in one part.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Yeah. Wink, wink, nod, nod. For me, it's I'm a big fan of, like, psychological thrillers, so that aspect of it is very fascinating to me, especially in issue number 22, where he's running around with his own skull, which is his humanity. Yeah. It's a symbolism of his humanity, and he's trying to, like, hang on to it, but then realizes he has to let go of it. That was fascinating, and he's talking to the skull, and you had mentioned before we recorded, like, he wouldn't necessarily see that today.
It's I don't think so. Obvious. It's so obvious, but also so dense.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that writers want to do that anymore. When books are dense now, they're just dense.
Mm-hmm.
Like Fearscape is a good example of that. A lot of the Vault comics are a good example of that. And I like those. You get a lot out of engaging with those books and trying to understand the point that the artist and the writer are trying to make.
Yeah.
And how that applies to you. But they would never, ever have Swamp Thing running around in a fever dream with his skull, and the skull is saying, I'm your humanity, I'm important.
Yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. It's not really a big two book of today, is it? It's more of like an indies title. Like you'd see this at Aftershock or Vault or TKO or something like that. It's taking chances, and I'd love to know the back. Maybe there is already this information out there, but I'd love to know the backstory of, like, what was the publisher thinking when they were like, Alan, just go ahead, do whatever you want. Like, was there anyone overseeing him going, could you get Batman in this issue? Because it's, you know, the sales could go up.
Yeah.
I also love the body horror in here.
Mm-hmm.
In that issue you were mentioning, Swamped, he's rooted. Swamp Thing is rooted to the ground. And there's water flowing out of his mouth and eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just so freaking weird looking. And I don't know, it just makes you want to scratch. Like, he's got these tubers growing on him, and I don't know, it's like, it's really bending what Swamp Thing is. It's his humanoid form isn't necessarily needed, right? He even says at one point later in the arc, you know, the woman is asking him, like, why aren't you breathing? He's like, ah, I gave it up.
And then, like, that's, like, the very direct, digestible part of it. Like, I stopped, whatever. And then a second later, he says, you never realize how much work it is.
Right. Right.
And, like, Alan Moore is so good at that.
I love the idea of, like, his breathing was almost like an addiction, like drinking alcohol or smoking, right? Mm-hmm. It was just something he did.
Mm-hmm.
And now he realizes he can let go of it.
That it was all kind of illusory. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And this character, that kind of leads to my next point, which is interesting. The character he doesn't have to worry about, you know, life or death. He knows he's going to live. Well, he doesn't necessarily know, but he's part of the green. Like, there's a scene where he's in the green and it's like he's in heaven and he's at ease. Mm-hmm. And that's so contrary to most superhero comics, especially at the time.
Yeah.
Where characters are always stressing out or worried or trying to solve a problem. Swamp Thing's just kind of, he is.
And I think more recent takes on Swamp Thing have tried to make that, like, a little perverse and scary, that, like, he taps into the green and the green is screaming because the world is dying and stuff like that. And that's totally poignant. It's totally appropriate, but I think it misses the point of, like, when you have all that noise and that violence and stuff as the driving force of your comic, it misses what is to be gained. Mm-hmm. So you have to show, like you were saying, Swamp Thing kind of at peace.
Right.
What the ideal is.
And he just has such a different feel than a normal superhero.
Totally. Yeah.
And by the end of the arc, I think they've done a good job of explaining how he'll get into more adventures. He's not just going to sit in the swamp and float around with a swamp Mai Tai. He has monsters around him, other monsters that need to be vanquished. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot that works here, but not everything works. What didn't work for you?
So there's a couple of things. They're mostly nitpicks because I do think that this is probably one of the best comics of all time.
Yeah.
I'm not crazy about the lettering. Okay. There's some lettering that appears outside of the panels or like at the bottom of the page or at the top of the page. It's very easy to miss and it's very important. Some of it's like a poetic in structure or a major reveal. And it happens kind of on the periphery of the art and the other dialogue in there. And I have to imagine that Alan Moore probably wasn't very happy with that. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to miss. And I miss some, even having read this previously and knowing that that was a thing.
Mm.
I think that there's some also regrettable stuff that is related to probably the time that this comic was written.
Mm-hmm.
But like Abigail, she's going to work in a mental institution, a mental health hospital. And the woman that's like interviewing her starts describing all the problems of these quote autistic children. They're exhibiting symptoms that aren't autism at all.
Right.
And I understand that maybe the point was that this woman is totally checked out of these kids' struggles. But I also think Alan Moore could have researched and been like, well, that's not really autism at all.
Right. Right.
And that's kind of stigmatizing and damaging. There's a couple African-American characters that are written very stereotypically, too.
And like their language?
Yeah, like calling people candy ass and stuff like that. And I think that that's probably also the timeliness of when this book came out. But it certainly dehumanizes them a bit or makes them bit characters in a way that I don't love. All of the central characters are white.
That's true.
And there's some sexual violence. Or like, yeah, I think that there's some sexual violence and sexual imagery, especially against Abigail, and stuff that happens later in this series in particular, that I don't like at all. That I don't think fits the tone of the book. And that it feels totally superfluous and totally unnecessary. I think that Moore thought it was effective to show the Earth kind of attacking Abigail, I guess, as a opposition to Swamp Thing and his like loving embrace of her. But it's overly physical. It's overly gross. Kind of the only violence that gets visited on Abigail throughout this series is sexual in nature. I'm not crazy about it.
Maybe that's part of the horror too.
I think that it is. And I think that that can be done well. It comes kind of more for the shock of the visuals here than it does any sort of narrative breakthrough.
I didn't have too many problems with it. I mean, obviously it shows its age with the way it's written and drawn. But then that's a positive too, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Definitely, it leans on captions a bit too much here and there, whereas I think the visuals could have carried it a bit more. But as we all know from the way Alan Moore scripts, every single freaking detail was probably written in those scripts.
And that's kind of why I feel that he probably wasn't happy with the lettering.
Right.
Because it does totally get lost in the art.
Right. I think the Floronic Man, when he gains his power, there could have been more done to... we get a really good, really well-written series of captions where we see him like feel the flowers in Australia or whatever.
That double straight... double page spread where he's like, I'm feeling the redwoods. Wait, how far away are the redwoods?
Yeah. I feel like that could have came across a little stronger visually.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you're asking a lot of the artists to pull that off.
Yeah.
Also, the Justice League, I think it was done on purpose, but they're rendered a bit funny. They're not quite as human looking, I want to say, or like you can't connect with them as much. There's a lot of shadow work over their faces and eyes where they're talking about the Floronic Man and this threat. And some of the dialogue also seems to suggest that they're not sort of, their empathy isn't sort of there. They're just like, ugh, the Floronic Man again. And it's kind of odd how they're depicted here as if they're not necessarily the hero, which they are in the story.
I mean, I think that that's intentional.
Yeah.
But I also get not liking
it. Pulled me out of it, though. Yeah.
I do like the one caption that's very on the nose and is like, well, who's protecting Louisiana?
Oh, yeah. I think Green Arrow said that.
Pretty funny. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I also... I mean, I don't know. There's a scene where Swamp Thing realizes his identity. He knows who he is now, and he's got his arms out, and there's like a big red sun behind him, and he's just like so happy. And yeah. I just think it's a bit overly done. Like, yes, and this very unemotional character is now like had this breakthrough. I don't know. This could have been a great way to show him less emotional and yet somehow show it in an interesting, like, I don't know, maybe flowers are popping up around him. That shot, it's the last page of issue number 24. It didn't work for me. But yeah, overall, like, when you read it all and then you just think about it and ruminate over it, I think this series works so well. And it's timeless. I think people will be reading this 50 years from now. So, moving on, what is your favorite artistic moment?
My favorite artistic moment is in the first issue, or actually the second issue that Alan Moore wrote.
21.
But kind of the first issue of the actual arc.
Mm-hmm.
And he's waking up in this laboratory, and he's just read the Holland Report, written by Jason Woodruff. And the gentleman that has paid for this research and has had Swamp Thing's frozen, now thawed body, is standing in the doorframe, and he says, are you still intelligent? Can you understand what I'm saying? And it cuts to a shot of Swamp Thing sunken, scaly, red eyes. And it cuts back to the gentleman. He's like, the file on you. Look, I don't know if you have read that file there, but... And it cuts to Swamp Thing's, like, bark teeth with all these roots and stuff cutting around him, and it says... Yes, I have read the file. And it cuts to the man going, like it? And then
and he's sweating and he's like,
yeah,
nervous.
He's like nervous. And finally just Swamp Thing's eyes take up the entire bottom of the panel. And it's drawn in a way that it's like slightly diagonal, the view, as if Swamp Thing is already approaching this man.
Good observation. I didn't notice that.
Mad by his realization that he is not Alec Holland.
He is a monster.
Yeah, and I think that these like close-ups on Swamp Thing kind of dissect the character and how scary it would be to see him in person like that.
Right.
Because he doesn't really have a way of showing emotion or even necessarily intelligence, aside from the fact that he looks humanoid. And you can literally see this man trying to reconcile that. As Swamp Thing descends on him, I thought it was a really, really great moment, artistically.
Yeah, he freaking murders him.
He super crushes his head.
And it's gross, too. He pulls him into his body, like he suffocates him into his chest. Disturbing stuff. My favorite artistic moment was in issue 23. It's the beginning of the issue. It's a double-page layout drawn by John Teitelbaum, Ben, and... He is floating in this like weird, there's like cells and like roots and everything. And he's just like floating there, kind of sleeping. And it's like he's in heaven because he's in the green. At this point in the story, he hasn't woken up yet after being rooted. And he's like floating around. And he's just, am I at peace? Am I happy? He's asking these questions to himself. And he's like, yes. But then a giant green, red cyst shows up. Yeah, and it's the Floronic Man, as we learn a little bit later. And his perfect heavenly beauty, he could probably stay here forever until this negative thing enters and it's not wanted. And I just think the way it's laid out, the way he's floating, you can see his full body and it's, you know, the details in his body. It's just also so peaceful and happy making. And then it's just like, there is the conflict right there. This is everything that's leading to the conclusion of this arc. It's a nice wake-up call for Swamp Thing to realize he can't just be passive and sit in the green and not do anything.
I do. I love the title page here, the left-hand side of this double-page splash.
Yes.
And I was going to say another really green quickly world. That all of the title pages could be posters.
They could. It has awesome. Doesn't it have like a, I don't want to say, does it have like a hippie kind of feel?
Yeah, I think like a 60s throwback, but it's also got like splashes of like black metal. And stuff with the font work.
Yeah, the color is really well done in this page. What is your favorite narrative moment?
My favorite narrative moment is very simple. Abigail and Matt Cable have found Swamp Thing kind of rooted down in the swamp. There's water pouring over him. He's more a lump of moss than he is a man at this point. Jason Woodrue emerges from the trees and acts like he's a friend of Swamp Thing. I guess in a weird way he is. And he's starting to explain it, and he says that Alec has had a psychological breakdown that has caused all of this. And Abigail says, psychological? He's rooted. He's got bugs in him. What's psychological about that?
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's so funny. I don't know. I laughed out loud. Alan Moore wanted it to be funny. And then the way that this page kind of like, Woodrue is delivering this news to her very dispassionately.
Yeah, he's definitely a sociopath.
Yeah, and then he starts like kind of dissecting Swamp Thing and picking up these like external tubers and organs and stuff that he's growing. And she goes very quickly from like angry to realizing the intensity of the situation and the depth of the situation. And the page ends with her crying right next to Woodrue, holding up just this massive like plant matter that Swamp Thing's body had been producing. And the way that it goes from like so funny to so aware and sad in one page, and it does so by showing Abigail's emotional journey through the page, I really appreciate stuff like that.
Yeah, you the human element is never lost. Unless it's the Justice League for me anyway. My favorite narrative moment was in issue 23. It's a page where Swamp Thing realizes Woodrow is the reason for all of this calamity. And he's like, Woodrow, he's pieced it together who Woodrow is. He's still in his dream state and he's just waking up. And he says to Abigail, as she's running, Alec, he says, they wouldn't let me be human and I became a monster. But they wouldn't let me be a monster, so I became a plant. And now you will let me be a plant. You!
Yeah.
I just love the idea of Alan Moore has flipped the superhero on its head. He's not a man. He's a plant, but he's also a monster. This idea of a monster being cool with the fact that he's a monster, being aware of it.
Yeah, I think also that he...
leaning into it.
He does a very good job of saying, like, there's man, there's monster, and then there's also plants, which don't necessarily have their own alignment.
Right.
You know, that's cool.
There's a lot to like explore there.
Yeah.
So where do you think this story is going?
I think that I have read all of Saga of the Swamp Thing. I did so quite a few years ago, almost 10 years ago at this point. Wow. Some weird stuff happens. Some very good stuff happens as well. Like, there's a small demon that gets shrunken down by a boy, and Etrigan eats him.
Right.
That kind of stuff is really good and memorable to me. But then also, I think that you'll see elements of this run across Animal Man and across Swamp Thing in particular, but also kind of just the whole Justice League Dark thing is born out of this run. This, like, magical, unspeakable, abstract take on the DC universe, deeply philosophical, you know, in a way that only indie comics are these days. You can see elements of this run across all of those books.
Yeah.
And like we said before, even in Snyder's run. And I think that that's where we see this now, kind of balancing the man and the monster. No more so poignant than in Immortal Hulk.
Right.
Which I would say is kind of the companion piece or modern equivalent to this run.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The idea of a monster realizing he's not human and finding his humanity is a fascinating one to me. It's a journey that is worth taking going forward with Alan Moore's and also, you know, Scott Snyder and others who've contributed to this character over the decades. Because I think every human can get a refresher on how to be a better person. And that's sort of what this is leading to, isn't it?
Yeah.
How to love a woman, how to be a hero, how to do the right thing. These are all things that this monster is not yet quite capable of or knows how to do. And we get to witness him do that in action going forward. That's really cool.
Absolutely. And I think that it it always has the kind of poignancy of needing to find your place in the earth.
Right.
In the earth's ecosystem.
Although, when, you know, in the story ends with Swamp Thing using his words, not his might, to defeat the Floronic Man.
Yes.
And he points out that the earth needs humans.
Yep.
I don't know if that's true.
I think that is true, in that our ecosystem has been changed so monumentally
at this point, by human impact. Uh-huh. Gotcha.
That at this point there is kind of some essentialism, mostly repairing things that we have broken. But
right.
I think that it is true to a degree. True enough that it would introduce a flaw in Woodrue's logic.
Well, especially since he is humanoid and was human-esque before.
Right.
You know, what I just described, though, and what you described, I think, too, explains why it's so freaking hard to pull off a show or a movie with this character.
Yeah.
The main crux of what makes it so cool is more about narratively thinking about something rather than seeing. Unless it becomes some psychedelic, crazy CGI fest, which might work in like a Doctor Strange sort of way with the what they were doing with the magic.
I haven't seen the Swamp Thing show. The one season that was on DC Universe.
Nathan Simmons, who's been on the show, loved it. If you read his reviews, he loved most of the episodes. I only picked up the first episode. I couldn't get into the show. Mm. I just couldn't get into it.
I'll give it a shot.
It's a good platform for like a slow building romance, but also I don't know. It's not action packed and interesting enough to be pulled off in the way this works.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And then it kind of it would devolve into like a Monster of the Week thing, and that's not interesting, given what Swamp Thing is inherently about or what the narrative thrust is.
It's interesting. What if they did like an X-Files thing where it was like the Monster of the Week?
I don't know. But then, I don't think that would work.
That's the other thing. He's a very solitary character.
Yeah.
Right? He doesn't have a sidekick squirrel that he talks to all day.
Yeah, no.
That's the missing factor. He needs like a sidekick. What would a sidekick be in a swamp? An alligator?
A beaver? I don't know. It's Louisiana. Yeah, I guess gators.
Gators? He has a gator that talks to him. A ninja turtle.
I don't know. I have some friends from Louisiana, some very good friends of mine, that are going to be like, what are you talking about?
But as far as alligators?
Yeah, I don't know. I could be totally wrong. Sorry, Troy.
So that's the end of AIPT Book Club this week. What do you think we should do next week?
Oh, I hadn't even thought about it.
It's your choice, I think.
Mm, I will let you know.
All right. I know you've mentioned Batman Year One before.
Yeah, Batman Year One. We've done a lot of DC. Actually, you know what? I would love to do the first volume or two volumes of Saga.
Okay,
I have not read that since it came out.
Yeah, and we're in when is it supposed to come back? Next year?
Yeah. For the end.
This is definitely the longest gap this series has had.
Yeah. Well, hey, I'll let you pick real quick. Do you want to do Saga or East of West?
Ooh. Hmm. I've never read East of West past like issue one.
So let's do East of West.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll do East of West, the first volume of East of West.
Sweet.
Cool.
In our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, Forrest is going to tell you what he's into that's not comics related.
Yeah, so I picked this up on a whim. I had heard some very good things about it. I got myself an NVIDIA Shield TV, which is basically a Roku or Amazon Fire Stick on steroids.
Oh, interesting.
It's a standalone Android TV thing. It has an Ethernet port. It has an SD card reader. It plugs into HDMI. You can connect Bluetooth keyboards and mice and Xbox controllers to it. It runs like you can put I'm very into emulating games.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put ROMs for Nintendo 64, PlayStation 1, PSP, anything older than that, and then like Dreamcast and all that stuff onto an SD card and download an emulator and play them on there. And they run very well. They upscale very well. It's really, really cool. It also has game streaming like from Steam, from my PC, out to the TV. Mm-hmm. And I've been looking for a way to do that reliably for the entirety of my adult life. and it works very well. It's very cool. It also has like Netflix, Hulu, YouTube, all of that stuff. It's given me something to tinker with.
How about DC Universe?
I think that there is a DC Universe app. Yep.
Nice, because that's not usually on the smart TVs.
Yeah, so it's got the DC Universe, it's got WWE, it's got Fight, it's got pretty much everything that my wife and I watch. as well as the ability to like play games and read and do all these other apps and stuff. I think the only thing that it doesn't have, and I'm sure there's a way to do it, is a web browser.
Okay.
So sometimes like an app will say like, oh, you need to put this number into the web browser, and I have to do it on my phone, which isn't a big deal.
It's always so clunky though with the remote.
Yeah,
right?
It is.
Unless it has it has a controller, right?
It has a controller, yeah. It has a bespoke remote and then also a controller, mouse, and keyboard that I've connected to it. I do kind of wish I had gotten the Pro model, but those are sold out everywhere.
It looks a lot like it was made by Microsoft. It looks like the Xbox in a lot of ways, right? Yeah. The green.
Mm-hmm. So it's very, very nice. It's very cool. I would say any of the stuff that I've been doing with it is for hobbyists. Like I've been playing around with it. It has built-in AI upscaling for videos. And stuff, which is very cool, but also sometimes makes videos look grainy if you don't know what's going on.
Right.
So, but that kind of stuff, it's given me something to do, something to put some thought and energy into quarantine. And it's a cool way to digest just about everything. Because I was getting a little worried about how loud and hot my PlayStation 4 was getting while watching Netflix.
I was playing a downloadable game, Abduction, the other day, and it sounded like I had a wind tunnel in my living room.
Yeah.
On the PlayStation 4, I mean.
Yeah, so it's very cool. I like it a lot.
Dude, I'm going to get you the Pro. I see it here. It's on eBay for $1,995.
It's supposed to be $299.
That is criminal.
That's crazy.
You know, it's funny. I've been using GeForce Now by NVIDIA for 2 years because I only own Macs, but I like to play Steam games. It works pretty good.
Yeah, so that's what it uses. It streams them from your PC out to the TV.
So, nice.
Yep.
Very cool. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, that's the end of our show. Thank you so much for listening. Come back next Sunday. We've got more news, possibly an interview. Who knows? And make sure to like, subscribe. And if you review this podcast, we will love you forever.
Nice.